So if you're in Colossians chapter 3, verse 18, right through to chapter 4, verse 1, and it says, wives. So listen up. Wives, submit yourselves to your husbands as fitting in the Lord. Good, no one got up and left. We are off to a good start this morning. Let's carry on. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they'll become discouraged. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you to curry their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ you are serving. And anyone who does wrong will be repaid for their wrongs. There is no favoritism. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. So these verses were written first century to the first century Roman household, and it was a highly authoritarian institution. So much so that the male patriarch, he held the power of life and death over his wife, over his children, over his slaves. Paul's writing into that context and he's saying, not so in the Christian household. Things are different here. Because in the Christian household, the risen Jesus, he's the Lord of the house. And because of that, he gets very practical and he starts to say, okay, now in all of these relationships, how can we be transformed by Jesus, by the gospel? So he says, wives, allow your husbands to be responsible for you. Husbands, be subject to Jesus by loving your wife and placing her well-being above your own. Children, they're not just objects, but they're called to maturity and respect. And parents, raise the children with patience and understanding. And in their household, it was typical to have slaves. And so Christians who were slaves were to honor their master, precisely because he's not really the master, Jesus is. And Christians who had slaves are to know that they're not simply property, but members of the body of Christ. And so in this passage, we're reading this whole reshaping of the basic Roman institution, and it's being reshaped around Jesus. And it's Jesus who rules by his self-giving life. Now, he's not abolishing the whole system, but he's demanding it be transformed. So today we're going to read through two of these three relationships. We'll start with slaves and masters. And then we'll move to wives and husbands. And a couple weeks from now, we'll pick up on children and parents. One of the Sundays where our kids are up in the service with us. And we'll tackle that one at that point. Today, the helpful image we have in our minds is that of a dance. Okay, so I'm the last guy to be talking about dancing. Because I can't even clap and sing at the same time. Like, I've just got no music in me. I can try and learn some moves, but, like, I can't even do the floss right. Like, it just doesn't work for me. I'm not a dancer. I can't move. But imagine the dance. And not just the dance where you're off on your own, but the type where it takes two people, where they're moving together. They're flowing together. The same song is playing, and they're both moving to the same music, sometimes breaking away and other times coming back, always enhancing one another. And the dance partners, we've got a few different partners on the dance floor. Masters and slaves, they're dancing together. Wives and husbands, children and parents. Now, if one of them were just to stand there rigid, what kind of dance is that? Does it work? I imagine their partner could compensate, but it would be awkward, wouldn't it? And if both partners stood there with their backs to each other, what type of dance is that? And so in this passage, it's calling for this relationship that's focused around Jesus as Lord. He's the one. He's the music that's moving us, that's guiding us. And in doing so, the whole goal is that the gospel is the song that we're listening to, and it changes these most important relationships in our lives. Now, if one person were just to stand rigid, and he's countering this here, where it's not just self-serving. The life isn't about how can I just serve myself, but now how can I give? How can I sacrifice? How can I love? How can I boost the other one up? Then it's a beautiful dance. Slaves and masters. Verse 3, verse 22, it starts off and it addresses the slaves. Obey your earthly masters in everything, and not just when they're watching you, but also when they're not even around and they don't even know. Work with all your heart. Now, when we hear slaves, it's hard for us to separate in our own minds the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade in the European colonies, isn't it? Like, that's our image. That's our view of slavery, bounded in deep-rooted racism. The slavery back in the first century was different. I'm not saying it was good. I'm not saying it was beneficial, but it was very much just part of the fabric of society. People and economies wouldn't know how to function without what they had going on. It was by no means positive, but it more came from military conquest and economic suffering. And so we have to somehow shake in our minds kind of the recent slavery that we understand. And as we want to apply this passage to ourselves today, we can't just kind of make a one-to-one, well, boss and employee, like employer-employee relationship. It's not just a straightforward switch it over. But picture the church receiving this letter. And I don't know how they did it. I'm assuming all the richer people, they'd be up front. Slaves, they'd be in the back. Well, balcony. You guys are the slaves up there, right? Woo! So they're all in the back, and they all receive this letter. And the letter's being read out publicly. So, when they start reading the letter, and it says, slaves, obey your masters, everyone in the front, they're kind of looking over their shoulder to their slave in the back, and they're, you hearing this? Right? Listen up. You need to take note of this. Slaves are kind of hanging their heads, and they're like, yeah, we've heard it before. But here, it's shifting things. It's switching it up a little bit. And now, rather than simply being the slave just blindly obeys his master, it's elevating it. And it's saying, work with your whole heart. They were used to a type of dance that was more like one guy wielding a gun, shooting at the other guy's feet, saying, let's dance, right? And it's like, I'm not part of this dance, but I better join in for my own good and my own well-being, because if my master says something, I have to do it or I'll get beat. And now they're hearing, work at it with your whole heart, like sincerely and out of reverence for God. What type of work is that? And he's saying, not just when your master has his eye on you, but always, in everything, work at it with your whole heart. Now, I'm sure we can apply that beyond just first century masters and slaves, right? Think about yourself. Maybe you're employed and you're doing a job. Maybe you're just kicking around the home. Maybe you're retired. But whatever you're doing, this is what the verse says, whatever you do, work at it with your whole heart. And not just when people's eye is on you. And we're good at that, right? Someone's watching us. Work a little bit harder. Clean a little bit more. Do a little bit extra. Because why? It's self-serving. They'll think good of me. They'll be impressed with me. And it's very much, it's just self-serving. And he's saying, no, even when they're not looking at you, even when it doesn't even serve you at all, work at it with your whole heart. Simply not to boost yourself. And why? What's the reason? It's asking the question, who's your real master? Yeah, they have masters. But what's he saying? He says a few things. He says, first of all, sincerity of heart. Do it out of reverence for the Lord, as working for the Lord. And then he says it straight out. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. So who are their real masters? It's not the guy wielding the whip, it's Jesus. And since it's Jesus, imagine the first century slaves hearing this. It would be revolutionary, wouldn't it? You're not just serving that guy. You also just aren't your own master, where it's like, oh, I'm just going to try and boost myself and preserve myself. But rather, Jesus is your master. And because Jesus is your master, push your broom in such a way as to please him. Right? Peel potatoes for him. Clean up the trash. Do your job. Set about your business, knowing that it's Jesus that you're serving. And this is actually freeing. I think it's freeing in all aspects of life. Because if someone forces you to do a job, if they coerce you, sure, you may do it. Is there a lot of joy in that? You're reluctant. Do you come home at the end of the day just satisfied of, that was a good day's work? Now you're like, they made me do that job. But when you realize that it's Jesus that you're serving and it's not just all about me and that we have a better master, it sets us free. Because when we begrudgingly serve somebody else, we've made ourselves slaves to them. And they're not just our master, they're our enemy. And their voice is in our head and it brings the whole thing down. But when we realize Jesus is our master, it sets us free. Think of parenting. How many times have you done things with your in-laws' voice in your head? They'd want me to do it this way. They're criticizing in your head. They're saying you need to do it this way. And whether you're following along or doing it the exact opposite to assert yourself, you're almost a slave to that voice in your mind. But as you realize they're not your master, Jesus is, changes everything, doesn't it? Our whole attitude, our whole outlook. And now we're able to serve the Lord with our whole heart. And then he ups it a little bit and he says, and your master is going to reward you. So anticipate a reward. You've got this inheritance in heaven. And then the slaves had no inheritance. They hardly had any monetary reward. And he's saying, anticipate a reward. Set your sights beyond, my master didn't give me extra today, but my real master sees what I've done. And I have an eternity to look forward to him. And in doing so, the same is true for us. As we work, we're working to please our master, and we know that with eternity in him and the smile on his face and the rewards that he has will be so wonderful and amazing. He'll bring justice that these people lacked, and in our own lives as well. So when you feel that work is just mundane, the tasks of your day you don't really like, that you're criticized, you're overlooked, you're overwhelmed, you're stressed, know that you have a good master in heaven, and that will change how you work. And then he shifts gears, and he says, masters. The masters a minute ago were just looking to the back of the room going, slaves, listen up. And now they're like, ooh, we're in the hot seat now. I wonder if all the slaves in the back are kind of like, yeah, who's listening now, right? Pay attention, master. We've got something good for you. Or maybe the slaves already took to heart what was just said. And instead of just being self-serving, saying, finally, I'm going to get some relief, they're praying for their master, who just beat them that morning. And they're like, okay, how is Jesus going to transform them just as he's transforming me? So whether the masters were squirming or not, there's a word for them. And it says, provide your slaves with what is right and fair. Why? Because you know you have a master in heaven. Provide what is right and fair. Don't just give them the bare minimum. Be just. Think of them as a person. And often I think the mentality would have been, I'm saving up for a vacation, so the less I give them now to eat supper tonight, the more I have for my vacation later. Right? And it was very much the rich are getting richer, and the poor were going without, and there was no justice. But I go on, I really go buy a new lazy boy chair. And I don't quite have enough money, so I'm just not going to pay my servants. And then I'll have enough money to laze around while they do all the work for me. And he's saying, no, pay them what is right and fair. Be just in this. Don't just give them the bare minimum. Pay them well. And it's hard to think, what are modern equivalents? When people work for you, when you're at a restaurant, you're tipping, How can we view people and say, what is just? And often really, well, I don't have slaves, so does this really apply? And I don't know, do we just not see our slaves? Like, I'm paying $10 a month to own this phone. I've got my plan on top of that and everything else. But what child was working in what mine in bad conditions getting the materials to make my phone? I don't know. I didn't see him do it. Does it bother me? And it should. And I honestly don't know what to do with the injustices of the world. We get our cheap materials. We get our cheap clothing. At what expense? Sometimes we read about it in the newspapers and we're like, yeah, it's not very good. And yet we carry on because out of sight, out of mind. And I wish I knew what to do with that. Just transform the whole system and just change the whole structure. But just as Paul necessarily isn't going and saying, let's just abolish this whole system that's in place of the authoritarian structures of the first century, he was saying, what's your attitude? And how is the gospel going to transform your heart? And in transforming your heart, how can you lead to different actions? Now, Aristotle wrote that slaves were merely human tools, so how you treat them has no ethical bearing. You beat them, they die, they're just property. It's just a tool. Get a new one. But the gospel transforms our view, and it shows us, no, they're people. Made in the image of God. That's why we're to treat them right and fair. But not just their people, but he elevates it even more. And what's the rationale for treating them right? Because you also have a master in heaven, he says. Who is your master? You think you're the lord of your manor and you're the lord of your little empire here and these are all your slaves. He's like, no. Jesus is Lord. And because of that, that affects your whole attitude toward others. You answer to someone. It helps take us off of our own pedestal and to realize that I can interact with others, whatever position and status and role in life, with respect, with honor, to care for them. And don't we see Jesus living that way? He'd go to the lowest of the low and befriend them. He wouldn't go, oh, okay, project day, let's go to the poor area town and do our project. No, he saw them as people. Of them, and he cared for them. Now, honestly, I'd rather Paul wrote here and he just abolished the whole system. There could be equality between the slaves and the masters, with the masters not just owning 99% of all the materials, but they could spread it all out and figure something out. But he's not so much changing the big system as the hearts. And in reshaping our hearts around the gospel and being formed and transformed by Jesus, it's going to change our corners pretty radically. It's going to put a different music on so that now instead of just saying, do this, there's an interaction. There's a dance. There's a movement together and a respect for one another and a building of one another up. So think of your relationships around you. There's different power dynamics. There's different things at play. How is Jesus transforming you, knowing that he is your master, and shaping those relationships? And he's shaping the most influential relationships, the most important relationships. And let's talk now, verse 18 and 19, husbands and wives. Because not only is the gospel to change all our relationships, but what's the best testing ground? It's in the own home. Now, of course, first century Roman Empire was highly authoritarian. And the husband, he was the king of the house. The wife, the kids, the slaves were his possessions for him to care for. And the Greek and Roman philosophers, they wrote a lot about, okay, how can we have what they call the good life? What are benefits that we can have? And they had a special form of writing called household codes. And in these codes, they gave brief, punchy statements on, here's how you can better your life. If you treat your subordinates well enough, then they'll do what you want. So this is to your benefit. And it was always writing to the man, it was always writing to that head of the house and saying, treat others well, because that's to your own benefit. Do we have any sort of household codes like that? Happy wife, happy life kind of thing, right? Well, as long as we just appease her, then I can go on doing my own thing. As long as she's happy, then the home's happy. And we kind of have that. And often, they were self-serving codes. Keep order in the home so that I could feel okay. Now, I imagine they would have congratulated me because after I got married, I'm a picky eater. My wife was super nice and kind of appeased me with the food I liked. I don't really like potatoes, so she just never cooked potatoes, even though she loves potatoes. So one day I was feeling bad. I'm like, I'm going to make her this nice potato meal. Problem is, I'm not a cook. And I didn't have a recipe. I just thought how hard can it be, right? They're potatoes. So I chop them up, and they're in the frying pan. I'm putting spices on, and they took way longer to cook than I anticipated. And in that length of time, my creativity just went out there. What about peanut butter? What about this? I'm just adding all these things. Shalia was so gracious. She had to rinse them off and crunch them down. And then the joke goes on. I didn't have to cook for the next 20 years. Right? They could write that as one of the household codes. Go and blow your first meal, and then you don't have to do any work. You could just relax the whole time. There's probably a ring of truth there. It's a confession. I'm not proud of it. But often we do things and we joke around and they say, oh, I won that one, as this self-serving way to say, I'm off the hook. And Paul goes and he writes the same form as the writings of the Greek and Roman philosophers. And these are the verses that we're reading. This is the same form and style of writing as the household codes, but from a very different worldview. Not one that's self-serving, not one that's saying it's all about you. It's saying now, we've got a different master. How can we serve and love one another? So when he says, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, that word submit, it's got some connotations, doesn't it? It's been through the ringer, it's been through history, and is it a word that we value and say is positive? Or do we shrink back and go, oh, it's not a very good word? Unfortunately, throughout the centuries, and I'd say it lingers on and even carries on, women are often put down. Their personal feelings or views, we could say, well, Bible says submit. Set your own views aside. They're not material. Follow my views, because I'm the man. And the verse gets corrupted. It gets twisted. It gets perverted to the point where it's misused to the harm of many. And unfortunately, the verse has been used so that the wife sits passively and endures sin or even abuse, as if submit means that she has no right to stand up or resist what is wrong. It's twisted. It's wrong. The husband then can get away with almost anything that he wants. It's demeaning. It's diminishing of women. It suppresses who they are and their creative energies. And these warp views have changed our meaning of what submit means. And then we read these brief, punchy commands, and we go, the Bible, it's dated. It's even dangerous. And so we want to read this well, because words change over time, don't they? Like, we're coming up to the Christmas season. We're going to sing some Christmas carols that have some older English language, and the children are going to snicker every time we sing about a donkey, aren't we? Right? What did they just say in church? Especially if it's a happy donkey. Now it's like, what did the old English, like, what is going on here? Right? Words change, and over time, all of a sudden it's like, okay, that's a very different meaning. And now the kids all just snicker in the back of the church service. And when we read the word submit, our mind just goes to this place where it's been perverted and corrupted, and it's hard to know how do we interpret this? What does it mean? What is a good definition of this? And when we back up to chapter 3, verse 11, we read a couple weeks ago, it says, here there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. And he was breaking down ethnic barriers, breaking down economic barriers, and saying, no, under Christ, all are equal. And when it says submit, it's not saying that means one is superior and the other is inferior. That would be a misreading of the word. And in talking about different roles of husbands and wives, this passage isn't necessarily talking about roles so much as postures. But often we relate role with status. If you have one role, you've got a better identity. You're a more superior person. The passage just isn't saying that. But it's hard to say, okay, what are the biblical foundations here? What does submit actually mean? And it's a difficult one to define. And you read definitions in dictionaries, and it is even saying one person yielding their will to a superior person. And it's like, that's not what it's talking about. So what are our biblical foundations? I think first, it's more of a posture than maybe necessarily spelled out what it actually looks like. One of our people, I heard her say a while ago, a couple of decades ago, I wrote a 36-page paper in Bible college on this verse. It's like, wow. And then she said, and I'm still trying to figure it out. Okay, good, because it's not just clear-cut, okay, boom, here's exactly what it is. It's more of a posture, a disposition to honor and to affirm who your husband is and how he's leading in the home. I wonder if we can make a definition something like this. Now, I'm not going to go and change the Bible and take the word out, even though it's, I'm sure one day they'll have a different word as language changes over time. But I wonder if we could say something like, wives, joyfully join the beautiful dance with your husband. Interact with them. Follow their lead. Now, I already admitted I'm not a dancer. So, I talked to Carl this week, and he's the expert in all things dancing. He's shaking his head now. Sorry, Carl. We're going to see a demonstration in a moment. No. But in the world of dancing, even though we've come through all these decades, the guy leads the dance. How he steps and how he moves sets the tone and the pace, and the guy, someone in the dance needs to lead. And in the home, dance. Interact with one another. God, Jesus with our Lord and Master, he's the song, he's setting the whole mood and tone, and now it's the dance where you're going apart and coming together, where you're enhancing one another, where someone is setting the lead and another one's enhancing all that's happening. Now, the Bible talks lots about different structures, governments and people and authorities and teachers and students, and it doesn't have a problem with there being different levels of authority. And in having different levels of authority, it's not diminishing or demeaning the one who's doing the following and elevating and making superior the one who's doing the leading. And so a wife, it's interesting how the wife is not called to submit because of who her husband is. Why is the wife called to submit? As is fitting in the Lord. Because of who her master really is. As it's fitting in the Lord. You ever go into the fitting room? Trying some new clothes to see, does it fit? So what is fitting in the Lord? A couple weeks ago we read about taking off the old and putting on our new clothes. Clothing ourselves with the gentleness and forgiveness and grace. And what is fitting in the Lord? And because, wives, you have a better master, you have Jesus, who is your Lord, is saying, join in the dance with your husband. The temptation, of course, is to be self-serving, to say, I'm just going to live my own life and do my own thing. And here it's saying, no, lay down your life and walk with your husband. Join with him, dance with him, so that you're not just your own person, but together as a unit, you're enhancing one another as you follow Jesus. That's who your master is. And so, these verses have often been misused. I remember a lot of my friends in Bible college, the guys, they'd be like, "Wife, do this, submit to me." And they'd turn it into a joke. But it wasn't funny, right? Because it's demeaning. And it was putting others down. And we want to have our lives lived in such a way that as the world watches us, they say, "What's so different about this?" Not where the guys, "I'm the authority, do what I say." And the wife is like, "Yes, dear, whatever you say." But they're dancing together. Because they've set aside their own life. They've set aside their own values of it's all about me. And they're following Jesus and they're saying, "Now how can I enhance this relationship together?" And we cannot separate verse 18 from verse 19. We can't just say, "Okay, wives, here's your thing." And then the husband gets to bark orders. But what does verse 19 say? "Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them." And in the parallel passage in Ephesians chapter 5, it goes on and elaborate and saying, love your wife means don't serve yourself, but just as Jesus laid down his life, and that was his love for us, he gave up everything for the benefit of his bride. Husbands, that's the calling that we have. Now, our natural bent goes one of two ways. It's self-serving, and it can either go passive or it can go harsh. And you see this, right? Watch the TV shows. What's your typical husband doing? Feet up, watching TV. Wife's running around, busy, doing all the work and cleaning and cooking and kids. And the husband's, rough day at work today. And it's just very passive. Not taking lead, not challenging, not building up, but just sitting back. And then if you see the opposite end played out as well, if they don't go passive, then they say, "Okay, I'm going to do something." And they get harsh. And so he's saying, no. Don't just go one or the other. Here's a whole new way. Love. Put first. Give. Sacrifice. Build them up. Love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Now, as an authority, it's easy to be harsh. Dance with me, right? Do this, do that. Hey, why didn't you? But that doesn't make your wife's role very easy or a delight, does it? It's ruining the dance. And they still may choose to dance with you, and we praise God for that. But isn't it beautiful when you say, "I'm not here for me. I'm here to love you, to care for you, and to lead you, and to do all I can for the benefit of us together in a marriage." Love is not self-serving. It's putting the other first. And what an amazing role we have, husbands. So let's grow in this role of loving, not being harsh, but putting first. Let's love. Let's give. Let's practice this and learn how to grow and put our wives before ourselves and care for them and love them. And the rationale? Who is your husband? Or who is your master? Because husbands, we are not lords over our own little domestic empires. Jesus is Lord. And because Jesus is Lord, that transforms who we are in all our relationships. So my question is, which partner has it easier? Okay, it's not a fair question, right? They're different, and there's different commands. When you read books, you're going to read that many thick pages on wives submit to your husbands, and then you'll get one page on husbands love your wives. Why? I think the concept is easier. Just love them. What else do you say? Submit, well, what does that mean? There's all the perversions of it, and what's this? And it's complex as a concept, and so it gets all the attention and all the writing. But when it comes down to it, to love, especially with Jesus as our model and our example, that's a high calling. Okay, it's not a fair question which is easier, to love or to submit, but both are called not to be self-serving, put the other first, to love. And so if we were to get practical, what happens when? Right? What happens when? You wake up early in the morning and the kids are crying. You've both had a rotten night and you're tired. There's dirty dishes all over the counter. When we see wives submit to your husbands and husbands love your wives, who does what? My guess is the answer is as varied as there are couples in the world. Because this isn't dictating, okay, blue job, pink job. Here's just how it works. Here's just what you do. It's getting into the heart and it's saying, don't be self-serving. Put yourself out for the benefit of others. And maybe what happens one morning in that scenario, the next morning will be different. Because it's a new morning. And you're both saying, I want to serve you. You sleep in this morning. Oh, thanks so much. But I'll help out here. And you're dancing together and you're figuring it out and you're playing it out. There's a diversity of actions that's coming from a unity of heart. Where both are active participants in this dance. Now, what happens if my spouse doesn't? Right? When I do pre-marriage counseling with couples who are getting married and go through all sorts of different topics, I always ask the question, okay, well, what happens if one of the partners doesn't put the other first? They start being self-serving and it starts to cause attention. What is the other to do? My wife didn't submit to me, therefore I won't love her. My husband didn't love me, therefore I won't submit to him. What's going to happen? If one of the partners gets rigid and stops moving to the music of the dance, what do? Sometimes you see on those TV shows where someone doesn't know how to dance or play the piano very well and the other person comes in and totally compensates for it. It turns into a beautiful thing and the other finally, Lord willing, will come along and join in. When I go through that scenario with young couples, they're young, they're in love. They're like, that'll never happen. Right? We'll always give to the other. We'll always put one another first. It's just going to be beautiful. And I'm like, have you ever had siblings? Well, that's different. Because they wronged me and I was justified in doing what I did back to them. Well, I hate to break it to you, but sooner or later the day will come when your spouse does something that rubs you wrong. And you will feel justified in repaying them with wrong. It's true, isn't it? And we build the whole scenario in my head. Well, they did this. They started it. I just need to preserve myself. And here we're being called, no, let's lay down our lives. Let's not preserve self, but enhance the other. Be transformed by the gospel. And we get to celebrate communion now. And in celebrating communion, we're looking to who Jesus is and what he has done for us. He is our master. And what did he do? He gave up his life. He left all the glories of heaven and he came down to earth. He was beaten and mocked. He was put down and insulted. He could have retaliated, but he didn't. He could have stood up for himself, but out of love, he continued to give and give and give.